The Beasts We Bury by D.L. Taylor. Read by Brenda Scott Waslow and Jake Cronister. 1. Prospective Second Mancella Amaryllis Cliff. 15 days until the assurance. My father waits until halfway through breakfast to announce that I'll be killing something again today. Presumably, he did this so my mouth would be too full to scream at him, but I try to anyway and end up choking on my croissant. My sister thumps me on the back, and my mother dabs her mouth with a silk napkin as though she finds the whole thing distasteful, but my father just keeps talking, blathering on about what a beautiful creature he's found and how strong this quarry will make our family. Just beneath my skin, the animals I've killed before writhe in anger, squirming and thrashing until I feel like an overfilled sack that will rip at the seams any second. I imagine a tear starting at my forehead and splitting my body in half until everything inside of me is spilling onto the tablecloth, staining the porcelain plates, and desecrating the elderberry tea. I picture my empty skin collapsing into a puddle at the base of my chair, and I wonder if my father would even stop talking. I wonder if my mother would start. The assurance is in 2 weeks, I protest, once I manage to force the bread down my suddenly dry throat. You'll name me as your second in 2 weeks. Why now? My father scrunches his heavy brows, making a pronounced V in the center of his forehead. And even though he launches into another speech, one I barely listen to, his deliberately exaggerated confusion is more than enough to convey how ridiculous my question is to him. The impending assurance is why we're doing this now. And I should have known that. My barely chewed croissant sinks to the bottom of my stomach as another protest rises from my lips. But I thought, that's all I get out before the sentiment dies on my tongue and bitter embarrassment burns the back of my throat. I'd thought that father finally naming me his heir meant I was done with all the killing. That he'd decided I was strong enough at last and I could put it all behind me. Move forward. Conduct myself in my new role the way I saw fit. Clearly, I was just kidding myself. Excuse me, I say, scraping my chair away from the table and throwing my napkin on the plate. I make it all the way to the grand foyer before Mara catches up. I cross my arms at her approach, but she only quirks a smile at me with a half of her mouth that's visible. The other half, along with her left eye, is covered by a brightly colored scarf. Did they send you after me to make sure I don't run away? I ask. Of course not, she says. They sent me for emotional support. I snort, and the joke eases the pressure in my chest a little. I drop my arms and let her fall into step with me as I pass through the grand double doors and out into the courtyard. I want a breath of fresh air, but the towering stone walls that circle the grounds make the air outside taste just as stale as the stifling indoors. I frown at them, hating their polished gleam, their ridiculous height, their copious fortifications and well-manned guard posts, hating how small they make my world feel. So, Mara asks, her voice synthetically cheerful. Are you going to run? I glance at her, and then away. That depends, I say. How suitable are your shoes for an extended chase? She lifts her skirts and checks. They're slippers, she tells me, in the patronizing manner of an older sister merely entertaining a younger sister's ridiculousness. And they look pretty flimsy, but I can always kick them off. And are you prepared to tackle me if it comes down to it? I ask, wheeling on her. Would you take the scarf off your face to bind me and force me back? Would you use violence if violence was necessary? My tone is harsher than her.